Hi, my name's Paul Baines. I'm Professor of Political Marketing at Cranfield University and co-author with Chris Phil, Sarah Rosengren, and Paolo Antonetti of Fundamentals of Marketing by Oxford University Press. Chapter 6, Proposition and Branding Decisions. In this chapter, we explain the different levels of a proposition and the product life cycle. We explore the process associated with innovating new propositions and how propositions are adopted. We explain the characteristics and principal types of brands and branding, and we explain how brands can be built. So let's first of all begin with product levels. It's important to consider that a proposition, we use proposition to mean product, but proposition of course can be either a service-based product or a physical product. We tend to use the term proposition, but the core proposition of a product is the benefits that the proposition provides. We've then got an embodied proposition and an augmented proposition. So you can see any particular offering or proposition breaking up into those three components. So the core proposition, just repeat, is the benefit that it provides. It might be a functional benefit, it might be an emotional benefit. So for water, for example, bottled water, the core proposition is the thirst quenching proposition. The embodied proposition consists of the physical good or delivered service that provides the expected benefit. So if you think of cars are supplied in different styles with different engine seats, colours, and boot space, for example. And then you've got the augmented proposition, which consists of the embodied offering plus all the other factors that are necessary to support the purchase and any post-purchase activities. And with a car, then that might be the credit and finance, installation, various other things. So those are the three elements of a proposition. We can think of different forms of consumer products. We can think of durable products, such as bicycles, music players, refrigerators, and so on. Those can often be used repeatedly, or non-durable products such as yogurt, newspapers, which have a limited duration and sometimes are only used once. We can also classify consumer products according to how consumers make their purchases. So we looked at extensive problem solving, limited problem solving, and routinized response behavior. So we can also classify products according to the behaviors that customers demonstrate. And examples might be convenience products, shopping products, or specialty products, and of course, unsought products. So convenience products are non-durable. Shopping products are not bought as frequently as convenience products, but consumers do not always have sufficient up-to-date information to make a buying decision, for example. And then we've got specialty products, which may be bought under certain circumstances. So when a customer needs something for a particular, let's say it was an event, maybe they would need a particular pair of dancing shoes, then that would be a specialty product. And unsought products are things like funeral services and so on, things that you need in an emergency. You have to have it, but you're not particularly delighted about buying it. We could also consider the product life cycle in this space. Underpinning the concept of the product life cycle is a belief that offerings move through a sequential, predetermined pattern of development, similar, if you like, to the biological path that life forms follow. So the idea is that once you release a product into the market, that it lives and dies in the same way that a human might in their life, if you like. And it goes through five distinct stages of development: introduction, growth, maturity, and decline. And sales and profits rise and fall across those various life stages of the product life cycle. The product life cycle is a useful concept in the sense that it's important to try to build up sales of the product as it's released onto the market, and to recognize that it can take time to release a product and to encourage adoption over time. But there are many different types of product life cycle. We can see revival sometimes, so it may not always decline at the end. It may then resurge after an initial period, if you find a new use for the particular product. Or it may be that you come into to the maturity, you go through the introduction and growth stage, then hit maturity, but then instead of seeing a sort of slow fall off into decline at the in the final stage, in the decline stage, that what we actually see is a rapid obsolescence where the product just goes out of fashion instantly. And that's the kind of thing that we might see with fashion items, for example, with clothing, or with other fad products. When we develop new product propositions, we have three main options. We can either buy in finished products from other suppliers, perhaps from other parts of the world, or license the use of those products for specific periods. We might develop products through collaboration with suppliers or competitors, for example, or we might develop new products internally through research and development. And those are different ways of doing it. But the success rate for new product development is actually very poor, surprisingly. No more than 1 in 10 new consumer products succeeds. And according to Peter Drucker, the celebrated management theorist, there are three main reasons for this: that maybe no market exists for the product in the first place, that there's a market need, but the product fails to meet customer requirements, or the product's ability to meet the market, you know, the product's ability to meet the market need is satisfactory, but it's not adequately communicated to the target market. There are different examples in the book about how that might happen. If we're looking to develop a new product, then we tend to go through different stages in the new product development process. We go through idea generation, coming up with the idea in the first place, screening those ideas, developing business plans, and undertaking market analysis for those different ideas that finally make it through. We then go into product development and select the products that look the best. We then test market those products, and we finally commercialize the one or ones that come out of this whole process. And of those six different stages, each one can be regarded as going through a stage and stopping at a gate. And you may go through that stage and gate process each time, or you may stop each time. So if you start off with idea generation, if your idea is not very good, then you may never get to the screening process. Equally, some of those ideas, maybe there are 1,000 ideas in a firm, maybe 200 make it through the screening process. Then you develop business plans for those, say, and maybe only 10% of them get through, so you've only got 20 left. Maybe you then go through a product development process for them, and you find that only actually four make it through that process. You might then test those four in the marketplace and find that only one or two actually make it through into commercialization. So that's the new product development process. We can see that happens, you know, in many different ways. We give you the example in the book of co-creating the perfect pizza. So the idea was that Co-op Sweden actually co-created a private label pizza for its customer base, and it did that in association with its customers. And that's a good idea because often enough, one way of I mentioned that 10% of only 10% of consumer products actually make it are successful. In other words, 90% fail, which, if you think about it, means that it's costing firms an enormous amount of money. But a big part of the reason why new products often fail is because companies fail to take account of customers' needs, either by not consulting customers enough, or by consulting them but not necessarily listening to the results, or by undertaking research which tells them something that actually isn't necessarily the case. And we can also think about, so it's not just a case of how we release products into the market, so a case of how consumers adopt those products in the market. Interestingly enough, the process of adoption is a kind of knowledge stage where customers become aware of the new proposition. There's a persuasion stage where they become aware of it, but now they need to be convinced that it's something they should buy. There's a decision stage where they go about buying it. There's the implementation stage where the innovation's tried for the first time. And then there's the confirmation stage where they like it or they don't like it, and they decide whether or not to rebuy it. And this leads us to the concept of diffusion theory. Rogers in the early 60s came up with this idea that that actually when you release a product, people react in different ways. You have a group of people who instantly buy the product, and this constitutes 2.5% of the buying population. They're unusual people because they tend to be interested in a product very, very early on, almost at the point at which it's released. They'll know about it well before anybody else. You'll have early adopters who prefer to let the innovators take the risk. This is about 13.5% of the population. They enjoy being at the leading edge of innovation, having said that, and they tend to be pick up products fairly early on in the process. You've then got a group called the early majority, which is about 34% of the market, so nearly a third, so just over a third. They're a bit more risk averse than the previous two groups that I've just mentioned. They require reassurance that the offering works and has been proven in the marketplace. You've then got the late majority, similar size, 34%. They're skeptical of new ideas and adopt new offerings only because of social or economic factors. And then you've got the laggards, or a group of people, 16% of the population, who are suspicious of all new ideas and opinions. It's very hard to change them. It's very hard to change their minds, and they often have relatively low income and education, and take a long time to adopt an innovation, if they adopt it at all. Okay, so let's talk now about branding. A brand can be distinguished from its proposition or unbranded commodity counterpart by means of the perceptions and feelings that customers have about its attributes and its performance. So if you think of a bottled water brand, for example, such as Highland Spring or Crystal Clear, they've all developed their offerings with imagery that serves to enhance the customer's feelings and emotions about the water in the packaging. Brand positioning is a strategic activity used to differentiate and distinguish a brand so the customer understands that brand and not only remembers it. You can think of three BPs as far as communication about brand is concerned: brand promise, brand performance, and brand positioning. In other words, what the brand says it will do, how the brand lives up to what it says it will do, and how the brand actually tries to appeal to the consumer. And we brand because it helps people identify their preferred offerings. It reduces levels of perceived risk for consumers. It helps people gauge a level of quality or experience of a service or product. Reduce the amount of time that a customer spends thinking about what propositions. It provides psychological reassurance or reward. It informs consumers about the source of an offering in terms of the country or company that's offering it. So branding can be quite powerful. It works on the basis of the development of brand associations. So brands have specific dimensions. They might have, for example, dimensions of sophistication or competence or excitement or sincerity or ruggedness, for example. And these dimensions link to a particular brand and create a personality for that brand. When we choose a brand name, it's critical because ideally it should enable a brand to be easily recalled, spelled and spoken, strategically consistent with the organization's branding policies, indicative of the offering's major benefits and characteristics. It should be distinctive, so it's different from all the other companies, meaningful in some way to the customer, and capable of registration and protection. And we can have different forms of branding. We might individually brand an product. So for example, individual brands offered by Unilever are things like Knorr, CIF, and Dove, the soap. And Procter & Gamble, we might have Fairy, the liquid, for example, or Crest, the toothpaste, or Head & Shoulders, the shampoo. We can have family brands, so that's sometimes known as multi-product brand policy, and that's where the brand comes under the organization's name. So you've got things like Kellogg's with Corn Flakes and Bran Flakes and so on. You may have corporate brands, so many retail brands adopt a single umbrella brand in the name of the organization. We've got things that are examples are Carrefour, for example, in France, or Tesco in the UK or Asda Walmart, for example. Corporate brands in business markets might include IBM or Cisco or Caterpillar, and so on. When we're building a brand, there's different stages of brand development. There's the identity of the brand, who are you? There's the meaning of the brand, what are you? There's the response, what about you? And there's relationships, what about you and me? So the key thing is to build the brand objective at each stage is to build salience, so deep, broad brand awareness. First of all, in the identity phase, to illustrate points of parity and difference with other brands in the meaning phase, around performance and imagery. In the response phase, it's about creating positive and accessible reactions, building judgments and feelings in consumers. And finally, in the relationship phase, it's about building resonance between the consumer and the brand, and that's about building intense and active loyalty. And that's the brand pyramid, if you like, the building blocks of the brand pyramid. We're also interested in global branding. So if you think about global branding, do we have a domestic brand, an international brand, a multi-domestic brand, or a global brand? And building those in different ways is not necessarily easy. A domestic brand might be Thornton's or Timothy Taylor or William Hill in the UK context. International brands, maybe Eddie Stobart, for example, the distribution company, a logistics company. Multi-domestic brand might be a company like Samsung or Caterpillar or Diageo, and a global brand we all know, of course, and as companies like Apple, Google, IBM, McDonald's, and so on. Okay, so that gives us hopefully an overview of propositions and how we build propositions and release them onto the market, but also gives an insight into how we link propositions and branding policy.